You're listening to the Art of Move podcast, hosted by Dr. William Raybar and Anthony Manuel, where we attempt to create a grand unified theory of human movement, biomechanics, and training. If you enjoy these episodes, you can watch them streamed live on nofilter.net, where you can interact directly and have all your questions answered in real time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Art of Move podcast with myself, Anthony Manuel, my good friend, Dr. William Raybar. We're still out here in the Canadian Rockies trying to find the grand unified theory of human movement and biomechanics. Today, we are joined by Uber Boyo, the YouTube sensation who has knocked the socks off of a modern interpretation of Nietzschean and Jungian philosophy and beyond. He has some of my favorite societal commentary going, some of my favorite artistic expression on the internet, period. Also someone who I consider a good friend and a mentor. Really stoked to have him here for another episode. Today we are going to be diving into a little bit of semantics. We're going to be talking about words versus reality, how words inform and shape our reality, the importance of using precision in language, and how might this relate to human movement and biomechanics, might you ask? Well, if you look at the fitness industry in general, it is wrought with jargon. It is wrought with terms like bulletproof, like stability, like functionality and functional. And all of these words are kind of ambiguous in terms of the actual agreed upon definition. And they're often used just as marketing terminology. So we're going to kind of dive into a little bit of epistemology, a little bit of semantics, a little bit of words, and all of these types of things. And kind of explore how words and the discussions about some of these biomechanical aspects are really important to kind of agree, like have precision in language and make sure that we're not, like, you know, basically being wizards with our language and just deceiving ourselves and deceiving other people as we are exploring human movement and biomechanics. So first of all, man, thank you for joining us on today's episode. I know that this is you know, biomechanics is not typically the topic that you dive into, but all of these topics are very relevant as the conversation has been unfolding on our side of things. So we're really stoked to have you here to chat.
Man, I think I've said it to you last time, but, you know, Nietzsche's philosophy is so big on the body and the biomechanics side of things. It's something that I didn't have maybe as much and knowledge to be able to articulate about it. But in the future, I'd like to actually talk about it an awful lot more because it is very, very relevant. And all that stuff you're bringing up about jargon and all this, like, I can immediately go in and tell you some of the stuff I've been looking at recently and how it relates to what we could quite dive into. If you want me to actually just go straight into it, I might be
pleased to. Please do.
All right. So I've been reading this essay by George Orwell recently called Politics in the English Language. And he sits down, because I've been ranting about jargon for years, because I go into the college and the academies and I see all these professors and they're talking about abstractions and they don't actually understand what the abstractions mean. And they kind of, it's like an old priest banging the book in your head. Instead, they're banging the jargon on your head, trying to tell you you're supposed to believe something. Turns out it's Marxism, which is actually quite disastrous when you really understand what's going on. But anyway, I never liked that stuff. It annoyed me. I got into Jung. I found the same thing. You have the Jungians. It's all just blather that they're just spitting out, barraging you with jargon and all this. So I'm very jargon averse. And I was reading this essay by George Orwell recently, and it made me understand why, because Orwell starts to rant about the same thing. Now, he comes at it from a political angle. So he's talking about political correctness. So he comes in and basically says political correctness is a terrible thing. Now, he's talking about this back in the 50s. So it's not like it's in any way relevant to our culture, but actually it's fundamental, but it's not like the same context at all. He was talking about it back in the 50s, and he was discussing how he was noticing this trend of more and more political correctness showing up. And what exactly, why is this bad? Like, why is political correctness so bad, George? What the fuck are you on about here? And so he explains that the way you're supposed to use language is you're supposed to try to paint a picture in the other person's imagination. This is the most down-to-earth, simple, clear, a sincere way to use language. So if I'm like, want to talk to Will, and me and him are like, I don't know, cavemen or something like this, and I want to say to Will that, like, there's this big mountain out the back and it's got like loads of snow on top, but it's purple and all the rest of them are blue. Behind that big mountain there's a load of, like, you know, orcs, or orcs maybe I should say, elk or something like this. And the elks have like these big spindly sticks and all this. And if you go up this little trail that has all these pebbles on it, it will like turn around this big tree that's gray. And then over there, you'll get to the rock that will take you to the elk. And what I'm doing there is I'm using very tactile language to paint a picture in Will's head. And so Will hears that and he's like, fuck yeah, I'm going to eat some elk tonight, boys. Come on, boys, let's go. And he follows the pictures that I put in his head and it shows him what I wanted him to see. And then he's able to forget the elk and then we can all eat elk later that day and all this type of stuff. That's absolutely fantastic. So the use of language there is for me to use mouth noises to paint pictures, and that's a very, very useful and tangible thing. And what's fascinating is that if I'm to do that job correctly, those words have to reference reality. You know, like the accuracy of me painting the picture is everything. If I paint that picture wrong, Will gets lost and ends up getting eaten by a bear, which is not good for me, you know, because then I don't get any elk and we're down a Will, and Will's probably a good hunter. So these are not good things. And so the accuracy and the imagery is very, very important. Now, what Orwell points out with political correctness is that something very interesting happens, where you see with in politics, there's obviously this interesting need to deceive. So you have a Stalin, you know. Now, Stalin's just after taking over Russia, and Stalin doesn't want to turn around and be like, you know, I'm going to take all my political enemies and I'm going to rip them out of their house in the middle of the night, and I'm going to strangle the men on the kitchen table and then throw them in a car and then wrap them up in a body bag and dump them in a river, and then take the women and the children and send them to Siberia to dig the ground with their hands until they get frostbite and their fingers fall off for being, you know, against the communist regime. He doesn't want to say that, because if he said that publicly, if he told the world, if he told Russia this is what he was doing to his enemies, they'd be like, this guy's a fucking monster. So Stalin needs to lie. He can't be straightforward. So instead, what Stalin does is he uses a bit of jargon. It's very, very fascinating. So he turns around and he says, well, we have de-radicalized our political opposition, he might say, you know, or our political opposition has been neutralized. Or them the people unfriendly to the fine USSR movement have been dispatched and disposed of, or something like this. And you see here that these abstract words, these you know, nice sounding words, are used in the place of the tactile reality, because we want to hide what's going on. Now, this is very Machiavelli. This is Stalin trying to like butcher people and all this stuff. But once Orwell points this out, he says that this starts to show up in all sorts of ways. Politicians will use it in a Machiavelli way, that, like, you see, maybe we can't talk about it, but like certain prime ministers of certain countries would say stuff like all this political correct stuff. And they don't actually mean, it's like, what are they actually saying? Nothing. There's no words underneath this. It's amazing listening to it. There's no tactile meaning. They're not trying to show me any elk. They're just trying to bewilder me with pretty sounding words so I shut the fuck up and let them do their job, which is to rinse me somehow, something like this. Yeah. And then Orwell also points out that there's a side of this where people are kind of like stupid. Like, there's people who just don't know what they're talking about. They, like, if you ask them what are they trying to talk about, they don't understand that they're trying to send you towards elk, or they're trying to give you a, they're not saying anything. This is very much like the academics. So you go into a philosophy class and he's talking about like the conceptual Jungian analysis of like psychoanalysis and the fluxing compositions of all the various tactile illusions of considerate of all this type of stuff, and he's blathering on, and you actually try to peer down on what he's actually saying, and there's literally nothing there. He's using jargon to sound smart because he's learned that's what smart people sound like. But the actual substances of what he's talking about is zilch, is zero. There's no real meaning going on to it at all. And so Orwell got big into this in this essay. I found it absolutely fascinating to see the function of language in a very, very basic level. It even matches up with an awful lot of neuroscience. And you guys are in the fitness community, and you see this all the time, precisely as you said. Like, I will go in and I will go get personal trainers every now and again and stuff like this. And I like boxing, you know, go to boxing gyms and all this. And a guy will tell me to do an exercise. And I'm like, why should I, you know, he's like, juggle the kettlebells or something like this. And I'm like, why should I do that? And he's like, it's very functional, you know? Or, and you're like, yeah, but functional for what? Like, am I going to be a weighted juggler? Like, how is this helping me do what I need to do? He's like, but it's functional, bro. Like, you know, if you look at the way your muscles move like that, you do that in nature, don't you? And you're like, bro, this is, what are you talking about? You know? But you can't really argue against it, because functional is magic jargon at the moment. And then there's like other pieces that are magic jargon. Like there's like you see all sorts of stuff like this show up at all sorts of times. So I think it's a fascinating part of human nature, how we relate to words and how it influences many of our decisions.
There's so much there. I mean, okay. So How about jargon within a community? So let's say for medical professionals, they talk amongst each other in jargon. So is that not a good thing? I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Or in corporate, in the corporate world, you don't want to get sued, or you don't want to catch, let's say, a cancellation. So you have to use jargon in order to avoid the situation where you can get canceled by using words that aren't exactly straightforward, right? So is there a good side of jargon?
Of course. Of course. Yes. There's two things you said there, and I think they're both very, very distinct. I'll deal with the second one first, because actually Orwell talks about this as well. When you look into the second one, what you're basically saying is that people are lying because they're afraid of telling the truth. And Orwell kind of points this out. He says, like, that's a very slippery slope to go down. Like, yes, in the corporate world, you have a HR who's like psychopathic and wants to fire you for saying that, like, you know, socks have are you know, should be worn in this way for men and this way for women or something like this. They're neurotic and they're coming to get your job, and that's scary. But if you allow yourself to start talking in abstract, vague jargon to avoid being understood at exactly what you mean, you are now going a very slippery slope. You're sort of doing a little bit, a very small version of what Stalin's doing. You're distorting the punctuality and the precision and the straightforwardness of your language for the sake of fitting in or appeasing the crowd or all these types of things. And so he's very critical of this. He says that this is something that we need to stand up and take responsibility for. We have to learn to speak very more straightforward and be more clear and not be afraid of sparking someone's imagination. And George Carlin has a brilliant bit on this, if you've ever seen it before, where he talks about the evolution of words, where we used to have this word called shell shock. And what is shell shock describing? Well, that's when you're sitting in a fucking trench. It even sounds like the experience. And shells are coming down and they're blasting you, and you start to get panic attacks because of it, and it fucks your nervous system up. And they used to call it that in World War One. It's like, oh, he's shell shook. And that's really intense, you know, two punchy syllables, shell shook, very visual. Shook by shells. You can see it in your mind. It actually triggers your nervous system. And this is, I think, where it'll start getting interesting for you, is that the words are so visceral that they spark either your visual imagination or even your feelings itself. And of course, over a long period of time, we started to de-radicalize that word and make it safer because we didn't want to trigger people's emotions, especially somebody who has shell shock. So it turned into operational fatigue. You know, now we're getting a little bit more jargon-like. Now we're starting to get a little bit more abstract. That doesn't quite hit the senses much more. And then eventually, what have we got now? Post-traumatic stress disorder. Post-traumatic stress, jargon. And it's like not, doesn't evoke any emotions. It's kind of neutral. And then now this is what you sort of see these days. Nobody knows what it means. Like you see people sort of describe it, and it's like everybody can have post-traumatic stress. Girls can have it, you know, like after someone calls them a bad name or something like this, or guys can get it from rugby matches and things like this. And it's actually mixed up with the kind of concept of trauma and stuff like this now. And it's become vague as a consequence. And so that's a big one. So the second part, and then the first thing that you're saying is, yes, of course, jargon is very useful. It's how we do abstract thought. So absolutely, it's a big deal, actually. And within industries, it's absolutely essential for the highest level professionals to communicate it. But at the same time, it's almost like saying, you know, swords are essential for war, but you should definitely know how to use swords if you're going to be wielding them. And a lot of people just like pick up the jargon and they never de-jargonize the words, try to ask themselves, what does this mean in a tactile sense? So you'll actually often go into most industries and find there's like 80% of it is made up of midwits who are just reciting abstractions other people made without understanding what they mean. So you go into philosophy, there's people always talking about the Ubermensch and master-slave morality and you know, nihilism and death of God. People are always talking about this. But Nietzsche invented the jargon. Nietzsche understood what it meant in a very visceral way. And a lot of these people have no fucking clue. And it's just like buzzwords that they slander. So
I kind of want to take a second to differentiate between jargon and like precise technical language as well, right? Because sometimes people can use longer words that are really technical within, like, for example, when you get into the nitty gritty of anatomy and biomechanics, and you're talking about like this, the specificity of a particular practice, the more academic you get and the more technical and precise and granular you get with a subject, you need basically to almost invent language. Like, Will, you and I almost kind of ran into the issue of not having words or language to describe certain biomechanical behaviors because the way that kinesiology and biomechanics had been set up academically didn't have a precise language to describe what we were observing. you know, in terms of some of the spiral dynamics of locomotion and everything. And so in a sense, you start to like make up words, or you start to use some of these vague, almost abstract terminology to explain a visceral reality. And you're trying to create a picture. You're maybe almost creating a sign or a symbol or a map for something that you are observing, and you need to have some sort of, so this is like technical terminology versus jargon. I think the way you can kind of make the difference is jargon is when you're using technical terminology, but you're not necessarily pointing at anything absolute or well-defined or well-agreed upon. Jargon is when you get that sense of vagary, like when you're talking about, you know, how shell-shocked sort of devolved into this cloud of PTSD, where you can apply it to so many different things. It's the same sort of thing of like, you know, if you're talking about functionality as it pertains to a specific function, like what is the function of this particular joint versus like what is functional as an overall broad term in fitness. That's kind of the difference there too. Cause I do think like technically precise specialized language has a place, but I think what jargon ends up being is when people hijack this highly technical language and they use it to kind of mask their own incompetence in a sense, or mask their own misunderstanding of like the actual visceral reality or the operational reality of what's happening.
Let me maybe just clarify something then, because that would technically be jargon, both of those things. But maybe I should be more clear, is that the misuse of jargon, you know, so you if you come across somebody and they're just barraging you with jargon, it's usually a signal that you should be a little bit sus. Now, if you ask them, it's like, could you actually define that? Anybody who's actually a good thinker will enjoy pausing for a second and explaining to you what's going on, if they have the time, of course. So absolutely, like the purpose of jargon is actually, as Will was saying, like the caveat, the devil's advocate here is that a medical professional coming up with a conception for like, you know, the coronary artery or something like this, like he's going to need to make a new word to categorize the artery, or motherfuckers are going to die in the surgery table. Like he can't just turn around and be like, oh, that's jargon, can't talk about it, just stab the knife in wherever or something like this. It can't, you know, he has to be specific. Absolutely. So definitely it's the misuse of jargon, and correct technical specific language is very, very powerful. I guess the question is about holding people to standards about how they use this, and also having an attitude of people being able to judge the jargon that they use. They're very like, you know, if you're going to use something, well, make sure that you're able to rip it down and explain the definitions and stuff like that. And you often won't see that is the case. Another thing that Orwell brought up that's very, very fascinating. This is again about language, and it might be hard for us as we only speak English, but he noticed as well how in English, like English is almost like a bad language specifically for jargon, because in English we have this fetish for Latin and Greek words, or maybe the English did in the 19th century. And so you'll notice with an awful lot of science that many things have a sort of Latin sound, a Latin twist to them. Like you use working in physiology, you'll see this all the time. Even physiology comes from logos, physiologos, which is two Greek words put together. And Orwell didn't like that, because when you actually go to other languages like German, which is a much more philosophically precise language, and the Germans for centuries made a huge effort to try not to do that. They were trying their best to create words using German metaphors. And their language is actually way, way, way better for precision. And it leads to this much more profound and poetic nature to it. So this is kind of going to be hard for me to describe, but I'll try my best here. So, for example, think of the word charity, which I believe comes from Latin or Greek or something like this. Now, the German word for that is Menschliebe. And Mensch means man, like Übermensch, and Liebe means love. So their word for charity is love for mankind, or mankind love. Man love. Well, maybe not man love, but mankind love. Love of man. Mm. Now, think of how much more vivid love of man is compared to charity. Charity doesn't, like, what is charity? It's actually an empty word, because we get it from Latin. Whereas Latin, all those words, they were related to their gods. They had meaning to it. So it's very fascinating when you see that. And German as a whole has this kind of quality of having, it's actually really easy to build words in German that are very, very tactile and visceral. Another famous example of this is something called Wanderlust, which literally means wander, love for wandering, love for like drifting around. And it's a conception of like that type of feeling where you go and you wander around the mountains and you travel aimlessly and stuff like this. And they're really good at conceptualizing this, but we don't necessarily have that. Like, that's like shell shock, you know, it's very clear and vivid. But in English, we actually tend to do this thing where we Latinize things an awful lot. And so, and that's a bit of an issue. Again, physiology, an example of this would be something like, do you call this the radial head, or do you call it the funny bone? You know, like, what's the, which one is more visceral? Which one evokes more of a strong emotion? And it's like, well, why couldn't we call it the funny bone? You know, I know you're trying to be precise and, you know, you're kind of weighing with it, but the radial head is quite abstract. It kind of pulls you into this Latin realm of words, and an awful lot of the muscle systems are like this. The gluteus maximus, that's like, that's Maximus is Roman, you know, gluteus is Roman. They're two Latin words. And why are we using those instead of like, I don't know, maybe the butt would be too crude, but we just seem to move all of our language away from this type of thing. So that's another fascinating thing to dive down with this.
That's interesting you say that, because now that you're saying it, I do struggle with this every day. People come into the office, I'm like, I got to say this in the way that a normal person would say it. So I do say butt, you know, instead of gluteus maximus most of the time, or funny bone instead of, you know, the ulnar nerve, which is, it's not radial head, it's ulnar nerve.
Oh, my bad. My
there's the jargon for you,
there
right?
There you go. Perfect demonstration there.
One thing I wanted to kind of lead into, one, there's a German word for when you get older, it's, I wish I knew what I knew now when I was younger. There's literally a single word for it. So that reminded me, I believe Robert Greene said it, but I wanted to go to what Orwell said in general, was that as language devolves, thoughts devolve, and vice versa. Could you speak a little bit about that? Because I think that's huge. If we have language that isn't precise, if we're using jargon and political correctness, our thoughts can literally not evolve. So yeah, could you speak about that?
Yeah, it's like, I think it's actually a really good example of, like, we could take such a practical example of you working with people as a chiropractor, practitioner, and say you just say to yourself, right, I'm going to speak in the Latinized Anglo speak that we use in English. And someone comes in and they complain, and then you do an assessment and you feel with your hands and you're like, all right, they fucked up their lumbar spine and they fucked up their gluteus medius and all this. And you say, all right, so what I want you to do is I want you to be aware that your gluteus medius and your lumbar is a little bit twisted, and your quadriceps, your fourth quadricep is screwed up. So I want you to do exercises that stimulate all of those, if you could please. Now, they didn't understand any of that stuff, and so they fuck off out of it, and they're like, I don't know what to do. Now, if you could have just said to them, train your fucking ass, you know, get under the hip thrust or something like this and get your ass going or something like this, maybe you could have said that. And so yeah. in the vague language, the person actually just doesn't understand, and something is lost as a consequence. It's a very, very practical example of this. And much more sinister examples is the way that you see this show up in, like, Orwell talked about this in politics an awful lot, but, you know, people come up and they blather all the political, what's the right thing to say? It's like, oh, democracy, everything about democracy is good, and anything that's bad is, like, you know, totalitarian or whatever, and all these type of things. And it's like these concepts turn into the basic concept of Christian good or evil, and nobody's ever saying anything anymore. You're just basically calling everybody you don't like a totalitarian and everybody you do like a Democrat. So, you know, it's like it just starts to, everything just starts to turn into blob and meaninglessness and just like trigger words and emotional buzzwords and no actual content inside of it. And so generally speaking, what he's pointing out is that, well, all right, in the real world, he's pointing out that the vagueness of language leads to a mirage, a lack of meaning, which actually sucks the soul out of life. First of all, it sucks the accuracy and precision out of life. It leads to human emotions getting caught up with the words as well, which is actually quite interesting. And on top of this as well, it actually strips the poetry out of life. This is a very, very fascinating side of things. Because if I'm sitting down and I'm talking to you about, like, you know, when you say these German words are actually really captivating to listen to because they spark your imagination. You know, they actually are very, very fascinating to think about such a complicated emotion like wanderlust or knowing what you know now when you were younger type thing. This actually adds an awful lot of vividness and richness to life. And if you strip that stuff away and come up with shitty words and bad conceptions and make everything jargon, it actually strangles the life out of things. It disconnects you from life. And this is sort of what George Carlin was saying as well, is that the people who have shell shock, you know, as that turns into post-traumatic stress disorder, it's almost like you're putting a condom on everything, you know, like you just never get to actually experience anything for real. And so people hear about these things, these ghosts, like post-traumatic stress disorder, but they don't realize that that might be holding a dying child in your arms that you actually just killed with an RPG or something like this. Like, they don't understand what life is, the vividness of life. Another example of this would be, you know, when we eat food and you go into the store and you have this like package of meat and it presents itself so perfectly and you just pick it up and you pay and then you cook it and it's, that's your protein and all this. But actually, for what had to happen for that meat to end up there is an animal had to like get its throat slit and it had to bleed out on the floor for a couple of minutes. And this is absolutely brutal, but your grandfather had to do this every single month in order for you to, in order for your family to exist and all these type of things. And so it leads to this gradual like sterility and lack of touch with reality. And it's maybe even hard to quantify how that fucks things up, but it definitely does. You know it yourself. So yeah, that'll be one thing. Orwell then talks in 1984 about a bit more sinister view where the government constrict the use of language in order to make people literally stupider because they can't think outside the confines of their language. And I think this is a more practical example of how that might happen.
That meat example was brilliant, actually, because I was literally picturing it in my head as you went. And I was like, that is literally the perfect analogy because it's squeaky clean. You go in, you get the meat, it's wrapped up perfectly for you. You go and you cook it. You don't have to think about it anymore. That's the words that are how it's strangled by political correctness.
It has a little cloth that sucks out there's like some juice. There's some red juice that comes out of the proteins. And so it sucks out the red juice so you don't get creeped out by the red juice. Like, isn't that amazing? And then your granddad literally had to like take basically his pet into the shed and choke that thing out with his hands and like be with his final moments. Just like... My granny used to have to do it. She used to pull the heads off geese before you'd eat them. And it was just like unbelievable difference. Unbelievable.
And it's funny because like I want people who are listening to almost like viscerally feel into imagining yourself in that scenario and what feelings you exhibit in your body. I think a lot of the times the reason that we gravitate towards these vagaries is because we want to protect ourselves from uncomfortable emotions. That's the discomfort, right? And a lot of political correctness is to not offend, to not hurt people's feelings with words necessarily. And that's a mistake. It's a mistake to do that. It should be okay to have uncomfortable emotions, especially if it's just through simulated realities that you experience through words. Can you be traumatized by visualizing something? Can you be traumatized by a story? I mean, like when you're younger, you watch a horror movie, for example, maybe in the back of your mind, you know, the horror movie isn't real, but you're like 6 years old watching like some guy stab someone to death. And that could like really like that throws your nervous system right off. And could you be told a story, a graphic, visceral story? And have your nurse, could that actually like physically damage a person? These are important questions to consider too. I think there's like a sensitivity that you should have about the power and the impact of words on the human nervous system and on the human being as a whole. But to avoid precision of language, full stop, to avoid feeling uncomfortable emotions, I think that's a huge slippery slope.
Well, do you get shell-shocked if you're used to listening to crystal clean, politically correct language all the time, then someone just hits you with a basic, normal sentence, you may get shell-shocked, right? Because you never hear it.
Think of this word, triggered. You know that word, triggered? Like, that's such a visceral description of like, oh, you know, you come in and you say, oh, I don't know, I don't really like this or that. You go and you say like an anti-Reddit opinion or something like this. And someone gets triggered. You know, you say, oh, I don't want the state to mandate certain things or something like this. And they're like, I'm triggered. They get a nervous system response. I remember I had friends in the last couple of years and we get in arguments about this stuff and they literally start to get angry. Like, you know, physically, I could see them getting riled up and it was weird. It was very, very weird. It's like, where's this emotion coming from? You know, how is your nervous system getting sparked with cortisol right now from me just fucking saying words, trying to tell the truth? Like, we're trying to talk about the truth and you're like getting up in arms. It's like, oh.
I had someone reach out to me asking to, sorry.
You're saying something, I interrupted.
That's my bad. You just cut out for a second. I thought you were done speaking.
That's I saw that me. Too.
Sorry, go.
my bad. I'm cutting out here. I was done speaking and I, I said I sort of half interrupted Will, so if Will wanted to continue, but Anthony, you're going to say something as well, so whichever of you want to go.
I was just saying, I post a bit of content about fasting, because I'll do some prolonged fast anywhere between like 48 to 96 hours, give or take. And I was posting some stuff about, you know, the process and how to do it correctly, and, you know, how to like make sure you're getting enough minerals and when you should stop eating, how you should break your fast. I had someone reach out and said, could you please put a trigger warning whenever you're about to post fasting content, because people who have a history of eating disorders could get really triggered by it, and it could cause a lot of psychological distress and duress for people who struggled with that. It could really, you know, set them off. And I grappled with that, because this is a good friend. This is someone who I care about and I like, and I'm trying to be considerate. But there was this moment of like, this is literally a health practice. This is something that benefits people's lives. There's, you know, autophagic benefits of your cells clearing out. There's, you know, your insulin sensitivity is improving. I'm talking about like the spiritual and positive health benefits, the character development associated. I'm speaking as like a total net positive. I had eating disorders when I was a kid. I weighed 300 pounds and I developed eating disorders because of it. I'm still talking about fasting as a positive, healthy thing. And I you know, on one hand, it's like, I understand where you're coming from. I really do. Because when you see things, the insidious nature about social media is that you're kind of more at the effect than the cause when you're consuming it. You don't know what's going to pop up when you're scrolling. Something could show up that creates a negative emotional response, which is why I really advocate for people to not use social media early in the morning, to not really use it much at all, to be honest, to not be in a constant state of consumption, period, because you're just always in this highly reactive state reacting to these things. But like that almost has to be, in my opinion, this has to be on the responsibility of the consumer, where it's like, you know, that you're going to be exposing yourself to potentially emotionally distressing things that are going to gross you out or upset you, or that you're going to disagree with, or that might trigger a memory of a past unpleasant experience that affected your nervous system in a negative way. So I really struggled with this one, because again, I was trying to be compassionate, but I really, really do think it is on the consumer to, you know, be conscious of what it is that they're consuming, and to develop the wherewithal to have a certain level of mental fortitude to not be so thrown off by the reactions to certain external stimulus. And if you know that about yourself, if you know that you're an easy case to be triggered, or you know that your nervous system needs healing in order for you to be exposed to certain things, then stay the fuck off social media. Don't be scrolling where it's like, You're kind of like, your main source of entertainment is a minefield for psychological distress.
Yeah, 100%. Will, let's go on.
Yeah. So that just reminds me of a Mike Tyson interview I saw, where he starts swearing and the guy's like, Mike, why do you have to talk like that? And Mike's like, turn off your station. If you don't like it, turn off your station. It's basically, it's to the consumer. And I think that's a solution to a lot of this is, yeah, you can say, hey, I don't want to see any more of this content. Boom. It's not on you. It's on the other person. And to take responsibility, I think, will cut out the problems with having to use jargon in order to save yourself from a cancellation, right? So that's just my opinion there. Very in general, the consumer should take more responsibility, and that would solve a lot of these issues. What do you think of that stuff?
Oh, it's a really crazy problem, because, like, first of all, I think there's a part of it where I just don't think we're designed for something like social media. You know, like, we've never, think about sort of what social media is like, it's almost like we're turning into neurons within a giant brain, and the brain is like the superhighway, and all the thoughts of humanity can funnel through it. And I like do genuinely think there's like very interesting questions, like porn's a great example of this. Like porn is very visceral, kind of shows you what it's up to, you know, like, it very much hits the nervous system, and dudes have incredible problems with this, and it's definitely on them to like not go and watch this. But it's like, well, what the fuck, like, how are you supposed to approach it? Like, are you supposed to blanket ban it or something like this? Are you supposed to like do like age sign-ins? Like, it's very, very interesting question, you know. Or can you even do anything about it? Can all you can do is inoculate your children against it or something like this, not give them phones at all? It's a very, very weird one, but it's definitely an example of something visual, something we could say mimetic, something that comes into your nervous system through your eyes, having a huge effect on your life. And I know people have like got erectile dysfunction and stuff because of it. It's actually surreal to think of the effect that like pixels on the screen have had in your nervous system. And there's various other examples of this, like the ones that we're, you and I are talking about here are a little bit more timid. Like I was thinking of like, you know, snuff things and like violent things of people actually getting killed and stuff like that. You can, like, that stuff shows up on the internet, that pops on your screen, and you kind of think about it. It's like, that's a weird one. Like, that's such a challenging gray area, because on the one hand, I'm saying, you know, your grandfather killed pigs on the regular, and then we don't see anything like that type of violence. And so we're out of touch with that reality. And then we're all here saying, oh, we should go and fight these wars, and we want the Russians and the Ukrainians to just nuke each other into obliteration for this great war or something like that. And then when you see these videos of like a Ukrainian soldier castrating a Russian guy, or a Russian guy blowing off the kneecaps of a Ukrainian soldier, and you see like the knife cutting off pieces of his skin, or the bullets going through his knee, you're like, wow, man, this is very real. Like, this is not just some game where you can go and you can have some political opinion and put the little Ukraine flag up there, or say based Russia or whatever. It's like these poor bastards are like shearing each other apart with like heavy metal. Like, it's extreme. And And in that case, is it good that violent stuff got shoved up in my face and kind of awoke that consciousness in me? Or is it bad? Is that kind of distorting my mind? You know, like all the people who might watch like videos of people hurting each, like, you know, murdering each other and stuff like this, and then they get inspired to do something like that. You know, that definitely happens as well. So it's a really weird thing, and it's like I don't even know if you can, I don't even know what to make of it. You know, you do obviously want everybody to have responsibility, but does everybody actually have responsibility? And nonetheless, I think something that I find so fascinating with this is, as we're sort of saying here, the effect that the nervous system has, that words or images or pixels or ideas can have on the nervous system. Like, it's so profound. If porn can get you aroused, words can get people depressed. They can put people in panic attacks. They can do all these types of things. And that's an amazing thing. And I guess this would bring it back to the big topic you guys talk about, such as like biochemistry or biomechanics and whatnot, is that it reminds me of how this all relates to pain. You know, like when you get a client in and they have an issue, they're going to tell you a story about what's wrong with them. And it's very funny, because sometimes their story can be complete bogus. You know, they've done loads of studies like this where someone will be like, oh yeah, I've like bust a disc in my back, and so I can't bend over and all this. And they take them into a CAT scan, and their back would be perfect. And they literally show them the CAT scan and be like, your back is not broken. Your back is fine. And they're like, no, it still hurts. And it's like, there's literally, your back is not damaged. And it's like, listen, my back is fucked because of this bulge disc. You just can't see it or something like this. Or whatever it is. There's like this weird way that we relate to pain. And maybe you could talk about that, because that's much more of your expertise than mine.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's actually a flip side to both of those where... As a practitioner, most practitioners know this that are, you know, keep up, is that I could take, let's say 40-year-olds. I can take 10 40-year-olds off the street, no pain, put them in the MRI, and four of them will have a disc bulge or something wrong with their back. So when someone comes in and they go get x-ray, they might be one of those four. So then they're like, look, here's my pain. I have it right here. This is the reason. It's like, maybe not though. Maybe like that's wow, people are looking for a reason for their pain, and they can get it from the image, and it may not be that case. Right. But like once they have that, good luck saying that it's not that. Right. So then they have a story to go along with it. And on the flip side of that, you can go into a practitioner who's using, you know, trying not to use jargon, saying you have a slip disc, and then slip disc might mean something in their head where the practitioner is trying to just use layman's terms, and it could get confounded there as well, right? So
Will, that's actually a great point. If I could jump in for a sec, is that the exact thing happened to me. That exact thing happened to me. Like I was doing loads of squats. I remember I was listening to Elliot Hulse, and he was like, you just got to go harder, man. So I went in and I did a fuckload of squats and deadlifts in one session. I did like, you know, max deadlifts, then followed it up with max squats. And on my way home, I was walking and my leg went numb. You know, I was walking with my girlfriend and I was walking home and my leg just goes numb, and I'm like, what the fuck? I never felt the feeling that lay down in bed, woke up the next day, my leg's still numb. I'm like, this is definitely not good. So I go in to the physiotherapist, and I like describe to him what's going on. And of course, he's like, yeah, dude, you've fucked your back up. Like, you've slipped a disc or something like this. And I remember exactly what you described. He said something like, I'm not sure if it was a slipped disc or a bust disc or something like this, but it was that very actual, like, shell shock. It was very visceral imagery, you know? He says bust disc or spinal fluid leaking out. I remember seeing that. And then I went up on Google and I looked at a video. And I was like, this video of this like perfectly healthy spine, and then it goes red and it just bursts, and I could see all the juice go out. And I'm like looking at this being, no, my leg, what have I done? And so he explains this to me. And then for about like 6 months, I would like not bend over, you know, everything was like robot mode because I was terrified that more juice would slip out of my spine. And then this went on for ages, you know, and I was like really, really struggling with this injury. And then one day someone told me about piriformis syndrome. So the little muscle in your glute, your arse, that wraps around your sciatic nerve can get tight. And they said like the way to fix it is to strengthen your glute maximus properly. And so I went in and I did like hip thrusts, and that they made them strong. Within a month, the entire problem was gone. It was completely fixed. So obviously there's nothing wrong with my back, but the image, like the visceral statement, just fucked with my head so much, and it left me with this chronic problem with pain, because obviously I was starting to get weaker because I wasn't using my muscles or my back or anything like that anymore. So yeah, it was very, very strange how that works.
Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, I had a major back injury, and I specifically didn't go to a doctor because I didn't want to get a diagnosis. I was like, I know I fucked up. I know I'm messed up beyond all reason. I don't want to know what it is. I'm going to move. Cause at that point I'd been personal training for a couple of years, and I was like, I'd had bad injuries, but not an injury that bad. And I knew that if I just like kind of wiggled around, but every time I'd been given a diagnosis for anything, like I've been told I was ADHD. I've been told like all different kinds of like psychological, you know, things, which again, you know, ADHD, what the hell does that even mean? What's the actual definition of ADHD in terms of the characteristics? The people are starting to use the word spectrum a lot too. You're on the spectrum of ADHD. You're on the spectrum of autism. You're on the spectrum of whatever. That's like that. That just means that the terminology or the diagnosis that you have is imprecise. It means that you aren't diagnosing a specific condition. You're creating a cloud to label people and just give a general idea of like for people to kind of label themselves, and they get kind of put into this sort of this vague cloud of diagnosis, and then they start labeling themselves, and they box themselves into this whatever preconceived definition they have or whatever they find on Google or whatever they find on like webmd.com. They start to like behave like it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy based on their own preconceived notions and what they're reading about whatever diagnosis they get, and they start to label themselves in. So when I got a back injury, I did not go, you know, to see if I had a herniated disc. I'm pretty sure I did, because I couldn't fucking walk. I couldn't sit up. I couldn't stand. I couldn't piss without it like feeling like my back was exploding. But I rehabbed it myself over 3 months just by gently moving and moving around until I could like fully move, and did the same sort of thing, you know, lunges and, you know, different stretches and glute activation, and made, you know, strengthen all the area around it and moved it around until I was healed. But I did not, like, I knew that about myself too. It's like, if I'm given a diagnosis, this is going to be way worse. I'm not going to add like mental strain on top of the back strain that I just had, you know, and torture myself into thinking, oh God, I'm going to be like doomed to have this for the rest of my life. And yeah.
Yep.
A couple points on that. Just quickly, like, things will heal on their own, right? So within the 3 month period, you, no matter what you did, you may have healed. So a lot of people do something within that 3 month time, and then they're like, that's what fixed me, right? So there's that as well, right? Where you may have done, let's say, hip thrusts or something. You're like, the hip thrusts are the key to fixing my problem. Or yeah. ATG does this a lot. I had this back pain and I just did length with strength, and all of a sudden my knee pain or back pain is gone. So this is how to fix the back pain, when there's a full spectrum of what's going on. And with that said, when someone comes in, I try to just give them positive thoughts. You know what I mean? Like the placebo, at least give you placebo. And for the most part, if someone comes in with the disc herniation symptoms, I'm not doing anything. I'm just spending an hour showing you how to move in a way that's going to be pain-free, so that you can cycle between pain-free motion so that you can heal yourself. Right. Yeah. That's just on top of that. I know it's getting off the subject, but yeah.
No, it's actually really good. I have a question because I broke this arm about 7 months ago. And this was actually quite an interesting challenge for my head because, like, when you break your arm, like, I the radial head is why I brought it up because I snapped the radial head off. There was, like, a piece of the radial head that came off. And then there was a ligament torn here. And there's another one broke out this way. It was really, really bad injury. Like, you know, like compound fracture with a ligament tear and all this. And I was thinking about the problem, like the surgery question, you know, because I think if I broke the arm and they set it and all this, I don't think I would need a surgery to put it back into place. I sort of like, I'll just let it heal. It'll be fine or something like this. But then with this one, I was sort of saying, man, I don't think I can willpower my way through this. Like, I think I better get the surgeons to go in there and take a look at it and all this type of stuff. And it's like, how would that work then in terms of, is there like a danger where you can say to yourself, there's nothing wrong, and then there's something is, and you can keep hurting yourself and make it worse? Like, is there like a limit to that, or what's the story?
Well, I can speak to that because I tried to rehab a shoulder injury. I snapped my ligament in my shoulder, tore my bicep tendon and a tendon in my shoulder. I had a slap four tear doing a CrossFit workout. And I was like, well, I've had dozens of injuries that I've rehabbed. I can definitely rehab this one. Spent a year, got like a whole certification in like flexibility training, and I did all this stuff. Oh. And I'm like, okay, I got to a point where I could overhead press my body weight over my head with a barbell, but I couldn't do a dead hang from a pull-up bar without pain. And I was like, okay, I've done everything, and it's still, maybe I'll go, you know, like my girlfriend was bugging me at the time, and she was like, hey, go get it checked out. Like, you got to see if it's actually something. I get an MRI, lo and behold, I have this tear. And the guy's like, honestly, if you didn't build so much muscle, your shoulder wouldn't be in the socket right now. Like, it was hanging on by a thread kind of thing. And I was like, fuck, okay. So I had to go get a shoulder surgery that I spent the last year recovering from, you know? And that was one of those things where it was like in my head where I didn't want to get a diagnosis. I didn't want to say, well, sorry, you really fucked up. You got to stitch yourself back together. I was like, no, I believe in self-healing. I believe in my competency as someone who understands my own body. But the reality was I needed more than just, you know, muscular strength and like long range tendon adaptations. I needed to actually like sew it back together.
Yeah. There's nuance to all this, right? Some things you can heal, you know, placebo, willpower, time, and then other things are like actual mechanical. Like if you break the wheel well on your car, or like, you know, smash into a corner and your wheel's turned like this, it's not going back straight, right? Like, yeah. And there's certain things that can work themselves out and then certain things that can't. So it's really nuanced to the person, right? But either way, you want to give yourself a good placebo, as much of a chance to heal yourself as possible right off the get-go. The major thing is when someone comes into me, I'm making sure they're not seriously injured, right? Like, So if someone really has a disc herniation where I'm like, this person needs to go to the hospital right away, because you can't, like, with the disc herniation, if it's bad enough, sometimes you can't piss or shit, right? So like, that would be a life-threatening, you know, I ask them, can you go to the washroom, right? And they're like, oh, I haven't gone in like 2 days because I literally can't physically push this out. It's an emergency. But if the person's like, oh, my leg's numb and I can't walk very well, well, we can work with that one, right? So there's nuance to every injury. And with yours, it was probably literally the socket, the labrum came out, okay? So it's torn. You can't repair that. Most people can't repair that. By the way, I have repaired mine almost. So most people can't repair it unless you really, really, really know what you're doing. And you can take a couple of years to let your body heal. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And at the time, I was still doing stretching.
And that makes sense. And I think this is where...
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go on, Anthony. You were saying something.
No, that's it. Please.
Oh yeah, well, I was just going to say, like, it really, I think it's a beautiful way to get down to the business with the conversation. And I think there's definitely a good justification. Like, there's an awful lot of jargonites. But of course, this is more of a conversation about language and the correct use of language and how language is about precision. And a lot of complicated things come into it, like intention, precision, how do you use language properly? There's all these fascinating questions about, like, you know, should we be using more visceral language or descriptive language when we're making up these technical names for problems or things that we discover? Like, you guys maybe see certain movement patterns and you say to yourself, all right, what's the best language we could use to describe this? You know, like, this is a really interesting question because it's like creating magic spells. If you sit down and you say something like burst disc, it's like, is that going to fuck with people's heads or something like that? It's like, or is it like leaking fluid or something like this? Are you able to like create words or create things that are actually going to describe things accurately and then permit people to actually understand what's going on, and then maybe they won't get in their own way and stuff with this. So this whole question of just precise language, precision of language, and obviously on the people to understand how fallible their brains are and how, like, a story can so profoundly affect your pain. It's so much so that, like, you might be getting hurt by an imaginary dream about what's actually happening when what's happening is not real at all. And then even if you become inoculated against this, you know, like, you can end up hurting yourself because you think that you're immune to everything or something like this. And it's about finding that balance and understanding the nature of the mind. So I find this very, very fascinating.
Ooh. Yeah. Sorry, were you going to say something?
I was going to ask.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
A bit more in a performative direction. Yeah. Because this is all like maybe the reactionary stuff, hurting yourself and all this. But I've heard some crazy shit. And I guess you could call it placebo. This is sort of going into the realm of placebo. Yeah. But it's also the power of the mind. Like, I've heard some wild shit. Like, this guy ran an experiment. I can't get the specifics of it. And he got all these guys to do sets of squats to their max. And they, you know, hit 300 pounds each or something like this. And then he went in, he gave them like a thing of water. Just like, drink this. And he's like, there's four tabs of diabinol in that. Like, that's anabolic as fuck, bro. You're going to be like, there's anavar in that shit, man. You're going to be explosive for your next workout. And they all go in and they all hit, you know, 20% higher. They hit 350 or something like this. And they're like, oh, I feel the power and all this. And he tells them afterwards, it's like, there was no, there's no steroids in that. Like, that was fake steroids. Like, you actually are a beast. You realize that. Now, this is crazy. Even though they knew they had just done it without steroids, they went in to try again. They couldn't do it because they couldn't do it again. They couldn't replicate it because they didn't believe, because they hadn't been like bewitched by the idea of steroids as being these superpowers. Now think about what that fucking means. That is so profound, is that there's this magical concept inside of our head, which is performance enhancing drugs. And when you believe that you're taking these things, your nervous system can do 50%, 20% more than what it can usually do. That's so bizarre. And then the second you don't believe that you have this magic limitless pill, you can't do the same thing. It's so profound that your brains work that way. And it just goes to show you, like, where you're at, what your head can pull out of yourself. Like, that's story and language influencing performance.
Well, that one's very interesting because you literally have to have the placebo in every study because it is so powerful. It's recognized even by the most scientist who, you know, is very rigid. You have to recognize that there's a placebo effect. Something within your head is making you stronger, or your belief is massive, right? So I can see that, but I think there's a limit to that. I think that you can wear down your physiology when there's not reality behind it. Okay, so like, maybe they could only do that one or two times, because you can push your nervous system, your electrical system, past a certain limit with your belief, but eventually your body's going to catch up. So I actually had this as a kid. Like, I kind of like saw it when I was a kid. I was really good at sports because I could amp my nervous system up like crazy. Like, I got on the field and I was just like, I was an animal, and I could see that I was just at another level compared to the other kids. But that wore down pretty quick. When I got into my 20s, I'm like, man, this is like wearing my nervous system down. I can't get up in the morning. It's very hard to keep that up, right? Yeah. So there is a physiological price you have to pay in order to have that, I guess, heightened placebo from, in that case, that would be, you know, massive amount of power at once. So yeah. It doesn't work continuously is what I'm reaching there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because our nervous systems inhibit a certain amount of force output specifically to protect the tissues that would be like broken down by exerting ourselves at that degree, right? And that's when you hear the story of like the mom whose kid gets trapped under the car, and all of a sudden this like 120 pound soaking wet woman like lifts this fucking car off of her kid that's trapped under the car. The part of the story that isn't told is what happens to that woman for the next 5 days after she did that, after she exerted herself, and like how wrecked her body, her nervous system, and everything is, and how much she has to recover from that. Because our bodies are really intelligent. They will auto-regulate a certain amount based on how what it feels safe doing, whether or not that's accurately feeling safe. Like our nervous systems can condition us to feel unsafe in situations that we would actually be very safe in. But we have that neurological inhibition of exertion to a certain degree, right? And a lot, I think a lot of strength training is honestly feeling safety and conditioning our nervous system to feel safety under these conditions of extreme exertion. Now, that being said, the mind is incredibly powerful. We had an interview with a guy named Gil Headley. Gil Headley is someone who's researched fascia quite a bit. And he talked quite a bit with us about how consciousness and fascia are connective tissue, are innervated connective tissue, is very closely interlinked. And he talked about his experience working with a guy named Dr. Joe Dispenza. Joe Dispenza is all about this visualization, creating visceral emotions through meditation, creating feeling states in the body through meditation. And by changing your feeling state, you're changing your neurochemistry, you're changing the state of your nervous system. And if you do this enough, you can create physiological changes in your body, and your body will respond appropriately. Now, Gil Headley, when we were interviewing him, he said, you know, I had this this major back issue that I'd had for years. And Gil's a smart guy. He could have probably rehabbed that. But he's like, yeah, you know, in 3 months of meditation, doing nothing else, no other rehab exercises, my back literally reversed this this reverse curve. And now my back is like completely straight and totally fine just with meditation. No exercise, no physiological intervention. So that's really cool. Like, that's really mind-boggling. You know, people reverse chronic diseases using some of Joe Dispenza's, you know, meditation techniques. So this is something that you can't discount how profound the mind can influence our physiology. But then, you know, our physiology also inhibits our mind as well to keep itself safe.
I have a crazy story about that. During that episode, I haven't had back pain in like years. During that episode, he was describing that, and I felt a sensation of pain in my back, like very, very strong, right? As he was saying it. And I realized in my head, I'm like, I got to take it more easy on myself. Pain hasn't come back since. I've been almost doing the opposite Goggins. Like, you know how people are doing 75 hard? I do 75 soft, which doesn't mean do nothing. It means be kinder to my body. And I feel like I'm more powerful now from letting my body recover and you know, doing certain things that I do to give it a feeling of safety, right? So that's it. It was crazy because the sensei, as he was saying exactly what you were saying, I felt a jolt of pain, like strong in my. I think I told you that right after the episode, right? Yeah. So it was just wild.
That's such an interesting exact demonstration of the power of language that we were talking about earlier. Like, how does somebody get triggered? And it's like, that's actually what it's like for someone, you know, like some person who's been brainwashed by the regime will say, to think that like all these things matter. And then you start talking about some political thing, you know, some cultural thing that's taboo. And they've been wired to have these emotional responses to this. And so you say these words that are just so silly to you, you know, and you complain about them, but then that actually evokes like these really strong emotions inside of them and sets them off. And then the same with what you're describing there, you know, like your body, that's even weird. You know, your body can listen to this guy describing this thing and your mind can put together the meaning and it triggers a physiological response. It's absolutely amazing. It's really, really powerful. What that means, it's hard to know. Another great example of this is in the fighting game and stuff, you know, like McGregor and Aldo. Like, what did McGregor sort of do to Aldo? Like, McGregor's sitting there and he's visualizing knocking Aldo out and all this. And every time he meets Aldo, he like puts in his head intensity and conflict and cortisol. Basically, every time Aldo sees McGregor, McGregor's in his face and he's making him hyped and he's making him aggressive. And so Aldo develops this like neurosis towards Conor, where every time he thinks of Conor, he gets a little bit tense and angry and stressed. And then obviously when the day comes, you look at these two guys fighting and Conor's there like relaxed as he's so relaxed compared to Khabib, for example. When he was fighting against Khabib, he's all tense. But against Aldo, he's relaxed. He's calm. He's laughing. He's doing his hair and shit. And then Aldo is like,
And Aldo walks up and he's like a robot coming up and he throws his big heavy punch. This is going to be the hero shot where he shuts this guy's mouth open and bang, unconscious. And it's unbelievable when you see it because it's like so profound how much McGregor controlled him all by just getting in his head and creating those type of those trigger moments inside of Aldo. Like he fucked with his head by turning himself into a trigger inside of Aldo's head. It's a very interesting thing to look into.
Yeah, he literally used language to mess with his head. He was talking about being, you know, the king of his favela, and like he would ride on horseback and like, you know, whatever to the women, and he'd kill all the men and he'd be king. And you know, it got under Aldo's skin, but he used words to do it. And yeah, you're right. At the time they were fighting, Aldo just wanted to bull rush him as hard as he can. And you could see that Conor was practicing that left counter left hook in the locker room because he probably knew that was going to happen. So very, very interesting.
There. Yeah.
It's bizarre. It's really, really bizarre.
Yeah.
And then the stuff about like visualization and healing, like I've heard loads of things like this. I'm looking into it as much as I can for the arm because I can't quite straighten the arm yet after the break. So I'd like kind of thinking what are all the things I can do? I was trying peptides, like growth hormone stuff as well. So that's the more physiological drug side of things. But I'd also like really want to explore that more and work on that. I remember when I was broke, like I was just lying there imagining a functioning arm moving, like with, you know, like it was moving on a grease paper. It was nice and soft instead of all stiff. So more of this is what I'm looking for.
And, you know, it does, like, your mind absolutely does create physiological changes. I think it is like the nervous system starting to feel safe, but there is actual physiological changes happening, like neurochemical changes happening. And I think that's also why we got to be precise with language as well and not allow nebulous language and vagary to emotionally affect us, because that's physiologically affecting you. Like if you're emotionally moved by jargon, you're allowing your physiology to be hijacked by something that doesn't mean anything functionally. You're getting frustrated. You're like you said, your cortisol is getting jacked up, or you start to believe certain things about yourself. You create a self-fulfilling prophecy about your own physiology. There's an interesting narrative, and actually it's probably true, about how the average 22-year-old man has the testosterone levels of a 90 or a 76-year-old man in like the 1980s or something, or the 1950s, whatever it happens to be, right? But basically, testosterone levels of young men are plummeted, right? And you kind of look at how would language, yeah, everyone's like, well, there's endocrine disruptors, it's the soy, it's the processed food. Well, what are the actual lifestyle factors? What are the cultural narratives that are not enforcing masculinity, that are anti-masculinity, that not only don't promote a virile masculine presence,
oh wow, yeah,
but also disincentivizes being masculine, you know? The feminist empowerment movement, while it may have done quite a bit for women's rights, also made men in a sense afraid to be masculine in certain contexts because of the repercussions of, you know, not being feminist enough. And there's all kinds of other things. How does the public narrative about masculinity impact our testosterone level? It probably impacts it a lot.
You know, this is actually such an interesting can of worms to open up, because you hear an awful lot of guys talk about, like, obviously your testosterone is like a signal for your manliness. So it's like we all cared. We were like, that motherfucker better be as high as I can possibly get it. I'm telling you, boys. And there's a lot of really interesting things about it, because what's the instinct most people do? It's like, all right, I'm going to try to eat a different diet. I'll get all my boron in and I'll get all my zinc in, and then my balls will be producing loads of tests and be big and manly, and people hear the depth in my voice and stuff like this. And I remember seeing a load of studies where people were talking about how behavior is one of the most reliable ways to jack your testosterone. Like, how, for example, how is a prison? You take the test of a dude coming out of prison, and it's like he has an hour to work out with no equipment, and he eats, you know, oats and slop every single fucking day with like 1,300 calories. How is he so jacked? How is his test so up? And of course, like the studies have shown this, but you can think of it naturally. He's in an environment where conflict and competition is very, very high. And they've even seen this, like if someone goes into competition, their testosterone will rise. Even if they lose, if they're competing, their testosterone gets higher. If they win, their testosterone goes through the roof. and these types of things. Like the actual behavior and the response to masculine behaviors actually leads to a rise in testosterone. So competing in things leads to higher testosterone. Winning leads to higher testosterone. Making money, more testosterone. Getting with the girl, more testosterone. Getting the good-looking girl and taking her for someone else, more testosterone. Competing with men for the girl, these types of things. Competing and winning, these all the ways that this can manifest. Your channel doing better than someone else's or something like this, or you competing with someone and succeeding, or even feeling like you're competing and getting that type of progress, that's all going to raise your test. There's all these interesting things as well where when your testosterone is higher, you look for more male status symbols and all this type of stuff. So there's this weird relationship between behavior. And then, of course, there's like self-image and self-identity, because if you think of yourself as high status, your testosterone is obviously going to rise and stuff like this. If you're treated, people treat you with more dignity and respect as if you're valuable, your test is going to rise as a consequence. This is very, very profound in many, many different ways, because it means that it's like, quote unquote, spiritual. You know, it's like spiritual, like it's behavior. It's related to our minds as much as it is to our bodies. And then there's also a really crazy one I've heard about, the whole meme that our testosterone is dropping, because I think I can't remember the ins and outs of it, but I remember seeing somebody trying to challenge that and basically say, listen, if you get a man nowadays and he doesn't end up getting like major endocrine disruptors and he lives a fairly healthy, normal life where he's treated with dignity and respect, or he earns dignity and respect and has status, his testosterone is going to be high. Like he's going to have high testosterone right into his old age. It's not going to drop. There's no, like that's not a necessary thing at all. But it's a meme that a lot of guys have put in their heads that has to happen. It's like, as you get older, it's going to drop. And our age is so toxic, it's naturally going to drop as well. And they actually become reinforcing prophecies because they think that it's going to drop. I don't know why. Maybe they allow their lifestyle to go. Maybe it's placebo, whatever it is, these phenomena begin to drop as a consequence. And then this is where some interesting behaviors come, because then what did they do when they hit 32 or 35 is that they get on TRT for life. So now they're starting to take drugs to replace their own testosterone and all this. And it's like, look, I get it. I know dude's doing that. It's better than being depressed. Absolutely. But it's very interesting how all these things are working together to reinforce this meme leading to all these behaviors. And it's like, well, how much could this be something to do with the way we're thinking and the way that we're approaching these types of things? So I find that a fascinating conversation to ponder on, although I don't know the exact studies and all this. So please do not quote me.
Yeah, that's really interesting stuff from the outside in, because I almost look at it. Looking at these memes from the outside, I don't really care about my testosterone. I don't want to go get my blood examined because I feel good. And I see this happening. I'm like, why is everyone so obsessed with getting higher test blood samples? Like, I need my blood to say this in order to be healthy. It's just like, we need to go back to me. I'm like, let's go back to a natural lifestyle where we're getting outside every day for 2 hours, getting sun. Like you said, And I'll give an example of this. I'm out in the forest, the wild animals here. I literally have to be on the lookout. And after that, I'm on high alert. I have two dogs with me. I go into the forest. I have my spear that I have and some ropes used as weapons or whatever. But not that I have to, you know, fight animals all the time, but there are dangerous animals. Caveman
Will was not a joke at the start, right? There. When I was,
yeah, but what I'm saying is I got to scan everywhere, right? I'm scanning. I'm constantly on alert. It's not like a, you know, Andrew Tate alert. It's like, I'm like just watching around, right? Well, it is kind of Andrew Tate, right? I'm always ready to go, right? So you get that high test just from that couple hours of you engaging with real life, where you can do whatever, like you could take a shot of TRT and then go on your phone for 2 hours. I don't think you're going to be feeling that test like you would if you were in a real life scenario.
Think about what social media would do to your testosterone. If you're talking about like the hierarchical nature of testosterone, if people win, if you're feeling like you're winning, your testosterone goes up. If you feel like you may be lower on the status hierarchy, maybe it's going down. Well, what is social media? It's maybe a hyper exaggerated dating app where everyone's trying to posture for hierarchy and status symbols, and they're doing the highlight reels and they're trying to show the best sides. And so if you're constantly inundating yourself with these high status people, these better looking people, these more fit people, these more competent people, you're going to feel quite a bit lower on the status hierarchy. You're going to feel much like lower in yourself. Even if you're an incredibly competent person in your own personal social circle, you might be the most competent, athletic, intelligent person. But if you're constantly inundating yourself with these images of other people who are more successful or good looking or rich or, you know, like they have these better looking lifestyles or they're happier, then that's going to affect your self-perception as well. It's going to affect your physiology versus spend 2 hours in the fucking forest. Tell me if you care about what the guy on Instagram's doing and how he's flexing, right? Like that's a totally, totally different experience. And again, it's this idea of reality versus a simulated reality. A simulated reality could be words. It could be a fancy caption. It could be a picture. But actual living in reality, Will, you're one of the most non-competitive people that I know. Like you'll debate people to get to truth, but I've never seen you actively compete or go against someone just to prove them wrong, just to show that you're better than someone. Like you're like the least competitive person that I know.
Interesting, because as a kid, I was always competitive. It literally switched for me moving into an environment where I'm in the mountains. I just feel disconnected from, you know, the city life. When I go to the city now, I'm like, this is an absolute zoo, right? Because I do actually spend a couple hours a day in the forest just by myself in nature. I think that's a major key and a major missing piece that most people have. You cannot really simulate this. You have to do it. It has to be outside and you have to be in nature. You have to, you know, be somewhat alone. So, I mean, that's kind of like my testosterone booster, I guess you can say.
Yeah, you're not going to get that from like red light therapy and grounding mats and fucking all the simulated experiences of nature, like actually going in the forest and being on your own with your dogs. Like that's a whole, you're not going to get a supplement for that.
No, all that stuff's good. That other stuff's good. But it's just like you just won't replace like the natural human need to be in nature and like be by yourself and have that time. So.
Yeah, it's really says a lot, like even the kind of simplicity of it. I remember I like during the summer, I noticed this so clearly when I'm outside for an hour to 2 hours in the morning, walking and getting the sun on myself and like ripping off my top and actually getting serious amounts of sun. I'll come in after that and I'll be buzzed, like, did you know, the best shot of coffee you've ever had in your life. I'll be fired up and in my head, you know, so funny, the stories like, yeah, vitamin D, nice. So I've got the vitamin D, but you learn about red light therapy. You're like, oh, it was infrared waves or something like this. But it's like, I don't know. The sun's obviously just fantastic for you for a litany of physiological reasons. And it's like the ultimate supplement when I get it. I always feel amazing afterwards. It's absolutely incredible. And it's so strange. Like you get separated from something like that. And you come up with all these, you rationalize so much to try to get back to that, you know, like I'm like getting my red light thing, I'm doing my grounding, I'm taking my vitamin D tablets, I'm doing all this type of stuff. And it's funny, like how you're in this state of like disease, and then you just get into that connection with the sun, and then that just all goes away. And then the injections kind of seem stupid, and the pills seem stupid, and you're like, I just want to get up in the morning and go out and suntan. It even feels good to do it, you know. And then that puts everything straight. So it's the simplicity of that. There's something very elegant and beautiful about that.
Yeah, and I think
goddamn pagan.
Well, I feel like that also is a symptom of using language and breaking things down into terminology, right? Like, oh, I feel better in the sun because of the vitamin D. Yeah. Well, now you're taking vitamin D tablets to try and emulate the same experience of what you get in the sun. Now, I don't know if you guys experience this, but like how much better do you sleep in a pitch black room versus a room that has like a little bit of moonlight in it or like some blinking LED lights? Like you sleep much better in a pitch black room, right? Now, what's interesting is like, even if you have a room that's kind of lit and you put an eye mask on, you still sleep better in a pitch black room versus a lit room with an eye mask, even if your eyes are completely, that's because we have photoreceptors in other parts of our body other than our eyes. And we're picking up information from light in not just through our eyes, through our entire body. I don't know if it's our entire body, but places other than our eyes, because your quality of sleep is better in a pitch black room versus just using an eye mask. We have a third eye, if you will, that is hidden somewhere along, or if not making up all of our body.
Can I counter that point?
Sure.
So, and I do agree with you that, yeah, pitch dark room, much better. But as a kid, My dad's a truck driver. I used to go driving with my dad all the time, and I could sleep in a truck with a truck bouncing and, you know, lights, all that stuff, Jake brakes, you know, sleep through it. So I conditioned myself as a kid to be able to sleep in any condition. And now it's like 30 seconds, I can fall asleep, which is, I mean, I watch a lot of my buddies and they're like, you know, I got to do this ritual. I got to have this room. I got to have this prep. I'm like, that seems crazy to me. You're not tired. You know, like, yeah. I don't know. It might just be in my head, but I conditioned myself as a kid, almost the opposite, where I could sleep anywhere with anything coming at me. And, again, it's almost like the testosterone and the, blood testing and all that. It's just like, when you see that, there's a little bit of weirdness on how much you have to do to actually get to sleep. Not to say that it's not going to be better in a pitch dark room.
Yeah, like all those things definitely help, but there's definitely, it's weird. The mind can help you an awful lot. I noticed this with my dad and him getting up early. Like he's just, I always feel better when I get up early. But all throughout my life, I would say to myself, I'm not a morning person because I was lazy and I would sleep in and I would go to bed late. And so I'd say, like, I'm not a morning person because when I wake up in the morning, I'd feel like cranky. It'd be like, you know, I'm just like, oh, what's going on? Probably just some bad sleeping patterns or watching TV when I was going to sleep. But that little story that I'm not a morning person was always a thing. Whereas my dad would wake up at 7. He wouldn't even need an alarm. He'd just like wake up out of bed at 7 with the cock crowing. And he's just going every fucking day. And he'd drink on Saturday and then got up at like 8:30 on a Sunday, you know, like he'd sleep in, quote unquote. And I remember then when I got older, I started to get up early sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes. And I noticed like when I get in a streak of getting up early, I just start to feel so much fucking better. It's probably just, you know, that's my genes. I'm designed to be I actually am a morning person. And it really just, it was just astounded me that for all that time I was telling myself that story, that I'm not a morning person. Things have to work this certain way. And then, you know, it just kind of breaks apart when it comes in contact with reality. So it's fascinating.
It is pretty interesting. Well, guys, I got to unfortunately wrap up. This was an awesome conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on this sort of foray into the idea of the precision of language. I feel like there's so many more avenues that we could have gone down, and we'll have to maybe dig deeper into this and kind of listen back and see what we can dig deeper into. But guys, this is episode 97 of The Art of Move, which is kind of wild to think about. If you're listening on YouTube, please like, comment, subscribe, share it with your friends. Let us know what you want to see for our 100th episode in a few episodes here. Go check out Steph at Uber Boyo on YouTube. You can check him on Instagram, on TikTok, but YouTube is kind of where the juice is. If I'm giving my own little biased opinion here, there's some really, really good stuff
on
there.
One of the top channels.
I'd say. I think so. Yeah. I binge watch it all the time. So anyways, guys, thank you so much for listening to The Art of Move. We'll catch you on the next episode. Dude, thank you so much again for joining us today.
Not at all, gentlemen. Thank you very much. And any boyos who are watching, please give these guys a follow. They are diving deep into this stuff. As you can see, like they're going into actually more specifics on the various things that we're bringing up today that I think are very, very fascinating. Many things I'm studying myself. So definitely give them a like and a follow and a subscribe and all that good stuff. And gentlemen, thank you very much for having me on.
My pleasure. All right, guys, we'll catch you next time.